Hello and welcome. This week, The Natural Selection presents Danger. Hello, welcome back. We are The Natural Selection. We were definitely a class, maybe a family, and in no particular order, I am Naomi, and I'm joined today by Nick.
Hello.
And Nick.
Hello.
Nick, would you like to tell any new listeners who we are?
Yeah, all right. We're The Natural Selection. So we're a group of taxonomists who are trying to bring our passion for nature into the wild. Each week we meet and try and just have a bit of a chat about nature news and interesting research from the week. And then in the second section, we talk about a different theme and how that relates to sort of animals and plants around the world. And this week's theme is danger.
Dun, dun, dun.
How are you guys this week? Have you had any exciting interactions with nature?
I had a bird day today, an unintentional bird day. I saw some peacocks today in Berlin, which was pretty cool. They always seem to come hand in hand with zoo. Walking by the zoo in Hasenheide, and it's a tiny little zoo, but there's peacocks there. And then later in the day, I saw 6 or 7 enormous, and I don't know what kind they were, but I think that they were swans very high in the sky. And then immediately after the swans, in the same moment, a hawk. It's a pretty cool day, bird-wise.
That's cool. I actually had a very similarly bird-orientated week. I also saw some peacocks, and pretty spectacularly, I saw them display. So that was really cool. We got treated to a display of the male peacocks with their tail feathers up and like doing a little 360. It was really cool. I also think, and not that they're not usually in the park where I go, but I was just a lot more observant this week. So I spotted a lot more birds than I usually would this week. I was trying to pay attention to them.
Sorry, Naomi, was there anything that caused you to have such a bird-filled week, attentive to birds?
Well, I was very kindly gifted a book about bird watching in London. So it made me realize how much access I have to such a great bird park near me.
That's such a considerate gift.
I mean, it would be if it didn't just rain all the time in London.
Oh, that's true. That's true. You'd really need something to help with that.
Don't worry. I also was very kindly gifted an umbrella, which I brought with me on my bird watching expedition.
Oh my God. Brilliant. Wow. What a coincidence.
So, Nick, what about you? Did you see any birds this week or some other animal? We won't judge.
Actually, no, the moment that stuck out to me was, yeah, a group of birds. I saw a very interesting thing. So the Spree, the river in Berlin, which I live near, has been flowing. But you may well know that it's been pretty cold in Berlin and the Spree froze over. It was ice, which is something that I've never seen before as a river freeze, especially a river that large. But this week, as I was crossing, it's been unseasonably warm. It's meant to be, I think, 16 degrees tomorrow. And the river thawed, except the edges. The edges are still ice, actually. Down in the middle, on one of the first days it's thawed, I saw a caravan of assorted water birds floating downstream.
What? How?
Well, I don't know how they knew each other, but there were swans, moorhens, and mallards all in the same caravan, just floating in the same direction. And it made me think, is this the first opportunity these birds have had to sort of be on this water so they're all taking it together? I also saw a swan in flight. Not nearly as elegant as when they float, are they? Look quite silly in the air.
So I think with that, we should get on with the news. Nick, did you have something to share with us this week?
Yes. I went to the well of things that are interesting and I pulled out this. Researchers from Queen Mary's University in London, headed by Rosie Drinkwater, have done an amazing study. Have you guys heard of eDNA?
Yeah. Environmental
DNA. And it's really, really useful in water environments because DNA can sort of stay around in water for quite a long time. So if you have a pond environment, you can scoop out the water, measure it for DNA, and you can get a good reading of lots of different things that have lived in that pond. Rather than having to get a DNA sample from individual animals, you might get a collection of animals, maybe find 10 or more different animals just from one sample of water. Now that's really, really useful in water, but the clever amongst you will notice that a lot of animals don't live in water. So DNA collection can be expensive and difficult. But there are clever ways to get around this. And one of them is something called iDNA. What iDNA is not eDNA, which is environmental DNA. iDNA is invertebrate DNA. Because sometimes invertebrates get DNA from other species. So if you think like mosquitoes, because they're biting different animals to get their blood, they would hold blood inside themselves and that DNA for an amount of time. Leeches as well would be a good example. Now, this researcher went down a different avenue. She was looking at dung beetles. Well, dung beetles are a great thing because they eat a lot of other things' DNA. Not on purpose, but by accident. And crucially, they eat a lot of mammalian DNA. So they could be an excellent way to find out what mammals are living in the area, and an inexpensive way as well. The species she was looking at in particular was Cathartius ranulpauliani. It's only a little species, and the reason she recommended it is because they're really easy to trap, because, in her words, the bait is inexpensive. Which is true, because it was free, because the researchers used their own.
Amazing.
Yes. So they were able to get these dung beetles, analyze them for mammalian DNA, and they estimate that perhaps the DNA will last up to an hour inside them. So they'll get a good reading of the mammals in the area from the last hour. Which is pretty cool. And it's a lot easier than catching mammals.
Very interesting. I wonder what biases come along with, like, you got to test it after it's just eaten some mammal poop within an hour. There's an interesting, like, I wonder what gets caught by that and what doesn't. But it's a cool new way of finding out things in the environment.
I suppose the benefit is that you bring it to you, because I was wondering what the difference between sampling the beetle itself and then sampling the dung that it collects.
Exactly. So they're easy to get to you. I did find a list of things they found. So it was in the forest of Borneo, and just using the DNA sequence from dung beetles, they found DNA from bearded pigs, samba deer, muntjacs, mouse deer, and porcupines, as well as the rarer banded civet.
Uh-huh.
So, Nick, what was your news this week?
Very similar, actually, in some ways, and in other ways very different from Nick's news. The news I've brought to you this week is of a research study that's also looking at new ways of getting DNA from animals and places that are hard to study. Unlike in Nick's study, the researchers of my study were not so much interested in current ecosystems, but past ones and how speciation and evolution happens over a larger scale of time. And this really is something that it's a big key problem in paleontology and evolution and genetics, and how do you figure out how things have changed over time when the main unit of evolution, the gene, is something that really quickly degrades once an animal dies. And so in order to figure out how speciation happens in the last like million years, you would really need to be able to sample the DNA over the last million years, which in a lot of cases has just been considered impossible for many, many years. And only recently, people have been starting to think about what is ancient DNA and how do we sample it and what limitations does it come along with. And this study was looking at a new way of doing ancient DNA sampling. And their particular study subject was mammoths. So in the most recent sort of research in this ancient DNA stuff, the oldest things that have been successfully sampled are a horse specimen that was somewhere between 500,000 and 700,000 years old, which seems to me pretty old. Right now I'm working at the museum here in Berlin, and I'm sampling things that are 200 years old, and it's really hard to get DNA from them. In this study, these researchers are taking DNA from a mammoth that's over a million years old, and they're trying to figure out how these mammoth populations were related. It turns out there were two distinct lineages, one of which we didn't really have any inkling that existed based on basically the morphology, what we've had to look at, the things that last, the skeleton and fossils and things. But this DNA says, well, there were these two lineages, and the two of them hybridizing is what resulted in the North American mammoth, the one that we know in the US, whereas one of the other lineages on its own ended up in the Siberian mammoth. These are the two main sort of distinct mammoth patterns. But the thing that I thought was most interesting about this is that even then, already in the 1 million year old mammoth specimen, the cold adaptations that are shown in certain protein coding changes were already present in this DNA that was sampled from 1 million years ago. So these mammoths like super quickly became adjusted to the cold. The mammoths that are from a more recent time have that same sort of adaptation. So we can see these changes over time and the speciation over time and how those patterns play out. It's really cool.
Wow, I'm still so impressed that they were able to get DNA from a million-year-old specimen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I failed to get DNA from a fresh specimen, so yeah, I'm quite impressed.
Cool, that's fascinating. My piece of research was looking at vivid biofluorescence that was discovered in the nocturnal spring hare. So this was a piece of work that was published in Nature Scientific Reports. So as our knowledge and understanding of the visual capacities of different animals improves, researchers begin to realize that animals don't see the world in the same way we do. They see it through a different lens. So many use cues from UV light. It's been found that biofluorescence, which is the absorption of short wavelengths of light and then the re-emission of longer wavelengths of light, has been observed in a wide range of invertebrates, fishes, reptiles, amphibians, and birds. It's also been found in mammals, and as we talked about before, it's in monotremes and the duck-billed platypus. It's also been found in marsupials, like the opossum, and in New World placental flying squirrels. But in this piece of research, they discovered bioluminescence in the spring hare, which is a large nocturnal rodent. They documented this in both museum specimens and captive individuals. And this is the first documented biofluorescence of an old world placental mammal, so a mammal from Africa. They were able to establish that this biofluorescence originated from the cuticles of the hair fiber. They looked at the chemical properties of what was causing this biofluorescence, and they discovered that it came from several porphyrins, which are commonly known for causing biofluorescence in other animals, and then one other unassigned molecule that they don't usually find in these mixtures, but may also be responsible for some of the biofluorescence. They also found that there was patchiness in these specimens. So in the piece, they described it as a funky and vivid pattern. It sort of shows an orange-red color. They also found that males and females fluoresced in the same regions and in the same intensity, so there doesn't seem to be any sexual dimorphism. And it wasn't really removed by washing. Initially, they thought that this patchiness may be because of grooming and that the others would apply the fluorescence through grooming, but because it didn't wash off, this suggests that that wouldn't really be consistent with that. And also, the pattern seemed to be consistent among an individual over the course of 14 months. So they're not really sure what the implications of this fluorescence is. Potentially, it's camouflage, this sort of patchiness, because they forage in these sort of open grassy areas. They are pretty solitary animals, and they live in these sort of open grassland environments. Like I said, the ecological implications are still relatively unknown, but it'd be interesting to look at in future studies whether this is because of a evolutionary trait, this offers some sort of advantage, or if it's because of a disease. Other porphyras are seen in diseases in fox squirrels, canefill rats, and in humans. And so what this research shows is it supports the hypothesis that the biofluorescence is ecologically important for these nocturnal or crepuscular mammals. Pretty cool. And also it may suggest that it's more broadly distributed than previously thought among mammals as well.
Since the platypus fluorescent discovery, there's been like flying squirrels and wombats and other things in the news, and now the spring hare. And it's so cool that we don't know what it is. It's like really exciting. It's like, and the pictures are so beautiful. Why are there fluorescent mammals? And why are we just now discovering it? It's a cool, exciting time to be at, to be alive.
Yeah, I think it's amazing that even with something as studied as mammals, to the point where people consider them overstudied or given too much importance, that it's taken us this long to figure out they're bioluminescent.
I think with that brings us to the end of our news section. Please do join us after this short break. We'll be back with our theme, which this week is danger. Welcome back. This week, our theme is all about danger and how animals and plants deal with dangers and or how we might perceive things as being dangerous. So, Nick, I thought you might kick us off talking about how we react to dangerous things.
Well, it's something that we all innately understand, that some things are dangerous and they are to be avoided. And sometimes that fear can be confused. We end up with phobias of things that may not present an immediate danger. But I wanted to ask a question to you two, relating to the natural world. Have you guys ever been attacked or have feared for your life because of an animal?
I have not been attacked. I did have a bear in my kitchen once, and I was afraid. And I grew up in a place where rattlesnakes were very common. So those are my, like, animal fears. But
You had a bear in your kitchen?
Yeah.
Can I ask what your immediate feelings around seeing such a dangerous thing were?
Like, I want to not be in this space was my immediate feeling. It's like, I'm going to go actually out the other side. Yes, so that was my immediate reaction, was like, I don't want to be here.
Okay, so the flight response.
Yes.
Okay. Do you think you remember that memory more vividly than perhaps others, or is it still a blur?
That's a good question. It's tricky to answer. I want to give you an answer that you would be happy with, Nick, but I'm afraid I won't, which is that I have pictures of it, which I think solidify the memory in my mind more than others' memories without pictures.
Unrelated to the topic, where was this?
Colorado.
Okay. Well, fair enough. That does sound terrifying.
It was scary.
Yeah. Naomi, have you ever had any bears in your kitchen?
I have not. No bears in my kitchen. I have been, I was bitten by a dog when I was a child. So I guess I was attacked. I don't really remember what my response was. I guess getting out of there and tears.
Because, yeah, I suppose for me what fascinated me was that idea that for most animals, being afraid of other animals is a daily reality. And it's something that we experience quite fleetingly, and it can be quite unusual. So I've been charged by a duck. And I remember, this is quite a funny thing because it's just a duck. But I remember backing off because I was like, well, that duck's coming at me. And then I remember thinking, like, no, I'll win. Like, I don't need to back off. Like, this duck is quite small. I'll win. So, yeah, in the end, it just went back to what it was doing and I carried on walking. But, yeah, but there are some amazing encounters. Some things are more dangerous than ducks. And one encounter that I particularly wanted to highlight was by an amazing author called Val Plumwood from Australia. And she writes about an incident from 1985 where she was in Northern Australia, where due to conservation efforts, there's a large amount of saltwater crocodiles, very, very large crocodiles indeed. And what she was doing, she was canoeing to look for ancient rock paintings which had been discovered in the region, but she couldn't find them. We're going to pick up on when she was paddling home. As I pulled the canoe out into the main current, the rain and wind started up again. I had not gone more than 5 or 10 minutes down the channel when, rounding a bend, I saw in midstream what looked like a floating stick, one I did not recall passing on my way up. As the current moved me toward it, the stick developed eyes. A crocodile. It did not look like a large one. I was close to it now, but was not especially afraid. An encounter would add interest to the day. Although I was paddling to miss the crocodile, our paths were strangely convergent. I knew it would be close, but I was totally unprepared for the great blow when it struck the canoe. Again it struck, again and again, now from behind, shuddering the flimsy craft. As I paddled furiously, the blows continued. The unheard of was happening. The canoe was under attack. For the first time, it came to me fully that I was prey. I realized I had to get out of the canoe or risk being capsized. The bank now presented a high, steep face of slippery mud. The only obvious avenue of escape was a paper bark tree near the muddy bank wall. I made the split-second decision to leap into its lower branches and climb to safety. I steered to the tree and stood up to jump. At the same instant, the crocodile rushed up alongside the canoe, and its beautiful, flecked, golden eyes looked straight into mine. Perhaps I could bluff it, drive it away as I'd read the British tiger hunters doing. I waved my arms and shouted, "Go away! We're British here." The golden eyes glinted with interest. I tensed for the jump and leapt. Before my foot even tripped the first branch, I had a blurred, incredulous vision of great toothed jaws bursting from the water. Then I was seized between the legs in a red-hot pincer grip and whirled into the suffocating wet darkness. Our final thoughts during near-death experiences can tell us much about our frameworks of subjectivity. A framework capable of sustaining action and purpose must, I think, view the world from the inside, structured to sustain the concept of a continuing narrative self. We remake the world in that way as our own, investing it with meaning, reconceiving it as sane, survivable, amenable to hope and resolution. The lack of fit between this and this, the lack of fit between this subject-centered vision and reality comes into play in extreme moments. In its final frantic attempts to protect itself from the knowledge that threatens the narrative framework, the mind can instantaneously fabricate terminal doubt of extravagant proportions. This is not really happening. This is a nightmare from which I will soon awake. This desperate delusion split apart as I hit the water. In that flash, I glimpsed the world for the first time from the outside, as a world no longer my own, an unrecognizable bleak landscape composed of raw necessity, indifferent to my life or death.
Thanks, Nick. Writing is so evocative and it's so intense.
It continues quite wonderfully, and I would recommend reading it. If you can Google Val Plumwood and read of her attack, she writes some amazing stuff and her perspectives are brilliant. But yeah, I thought that was a really good insight into that feeling of the most imminent danger that you can imagine from the natural world. Being part of the food chain again.
Yeah, and we've done a lot of work to remove ourselves from it. Mm. But sometimes we go back there.
Wow, very powerful, very chilling. It is something that is faced by lots of animals. I suppose we would think of ourselves outside of that, but like you just described, we're not. So a lot of animals deal with this trying not to get eaten. So one thing I wanted to talk about was warning coloration. And in particular, I wanted to talk about aposematism. That word took me so long to figure out how to say. Just want to praise myself for that. So that's where animals are brightly colored as an advertisement that they're unprofitable in some way. Aposematism is defined as a combination of unprofitability. So either this physical sort of protection, being toxic in some way, or just being difficult to capture. And also with this, there's a signal that shows this. So for example, you're probably aware of lots of different animals that have this. For example, bees, wasps, snakes, these bright colors like yellow and black or red and black that indicate, don't come near me, stay away, I'm not worth it. But these actually puzzled scientists for a while, because if you're brightly colored, you're also very obvious to predators. You're very clearly visible. So this is something that challenged people for a while, in that it seemed like a bit of a paradox how this would evolve. Because even though it's showing unprofitability, this needs to be learned in order for this to work. So how did this first novel, colorful thing evolve? It was a struggle for a while, but a lot of this thing, you give it as a paradox, relies on the assumption that predators will go for things that are bright and conspicuous. But actually, a lot of research was done in the last maybe couple of decades that suggests that actually being conspicuous isn't necessarily something that predators go for. So there were several studies that were done looking at predators and their foraging decisions. And the studies show that predators actually can often be quite conservative in their food preferences. So that even if there's something that's very conspicuous, and these novel prey morphs may not necessarily be at a disadvantage. And so this has been something this particular research paper I was looking at, they looked at this in simulated in the field and also in aviary experiments. And they use real predators, so birds in this example, and they looked at them foraging on successive generations of artificial prey populations. So they used pastry prey of different colours, and they set them up experimentally. So they had 20 individuals, and they had a single novel coloured mutant in the population. They'd already familiarised birds with one of the colours, and then they introduced this novel one. And actually they found that, you know, in some of these populations, the novel morph became extinct within the first couple of generations. So they treated these pastry prey as like an asexual population, so that after one day that they would survive and reproduce to the next, based on the frequency of the color variation, would influence the population the next day. And then, but they did find that actually in some of these populations, the novel trait did spread, and it actually became fixed within the population. So in this way, they were able to show that actually this is something that could spread within populations. I talked about it before in the mimicry episode, but my last point is there's also things called Müllerian mimics, and these are animals that use the same signal, because it's better for the aposematism is most effective when the signal is at high density. So it helps the predators learn this signal better. So that's why you could see a lot of the time this signal is shared among toxic species. They share a similar pattern in order to improve their chances of survival and showing that they are not profitable. There are other ways that animals use their behavior in order to avoid predators, not just by bright colors, but it's also in behaviors and how they react when predators try and attack. Isn't that right, Nick?
It is. It comes from the Greek meaning away and the Greek meaning sign, away sign. From memory.
Yeah.
Actually, do you know what? I researched that last night. It was something I genuinely looked up with my friend, who's a language expert. And so, yeah, I feel quite smug that I knew that.
Nice. Let me just say that, yeah, there's this like warning coloration, and this, it's sort of like a jackpot. Like, you can play slots, but if you never win, then you don't want to play slots anymore. But on the other side of things, if you eat things that are bright colored and all the time they don't do anything bad to you, it doesn't train you that bright colors are bad. But if most of the time you eat something that is bright colors and it's nasty, then that's a different response. What I was looking at is diomatic behavior, or startle display, which is very similar and often linked with aposematism, but it has a very different function and role in the predator-prey relationships. So when animals are faced with a predator encounter, or they're threatened or afraid, when they encounter danger, that's a very common response to do something that startles the predator or the things around it. And we can think, the most obvious thing that I can think of is cats. When they get afraid, they puff up and they hiss and they arch their back and they puff their tail out. So they get bigger really quickly and they make a really loud sound. And those two things combined are like, ah! It's startling. It causes a sort of bit of a fear response in many things, in me also, and in dogs that have encountered cats before. It's really well known, and you can probably think of some examples. In insects like moths and butterflies, eye spots on the backs of butterflies and moths are a really common form of diomedic behavior or diomedic signaling patterning. It's really common also in arachnids. And it seems strange because if you think of it only as in terms of eye spots, then you think, well, spiders don't have eye spots on them. But it's also anything that startles. So if these spiders, if you think of a big tarantula, when they get frightened, what they'll do is they'll raise up some of their legs above their body and make them look bigger, and sort of like they're like, ha! And even some tarantulas will hiss. So this hissing is a diomedic startle display inside tarantulas. And then it's also common in cephalopods, octopuses, and cuttlefish and squids do this sort of startle display as well, where they'll make themselves much bigger or change their colors quickly. I want to tie in from aposematism because they're so often linked. Something you mentioned, Naomi, was that you'd think that it's sort of evolutionarily not helpful to have really bright, eye-catching, attention-getting displays all the time on you, even if they're saying, don't eat me. Because they, if you're like walking through the grass and you see there's the red bug, like there it is right there. It's easy to spot. Some animals are, don't find it difficult to eat or whatever. But there are some animals, particularly moths, that are really good at hiding aposematic displays, like the peacock butterfly, which has, when closed, it's cryptic and it camouflages with leaves and branches. And when it opens its wings on the backside of them that is open to the outside, it has four brilliant purple and red eye spots. So it hides them when it's not flying so that it can stand still on a leaf or on a branch and not be seen. And then when it's startled, it opens them up and hopefully things like flycatchers and other insectivores that eat the butterfly get startled away by it. I read a theory that maybe it has to do with thinking that they're snakes or even on some of the larger moths, like an owl eye. But really, they are quite startling when you see pictures of these. And some strange ones, too. But the thing that I really want to talk about is rattlesnakes. I mentioned earlier that I grew up in a place where there's a lot of rattlesnakes, and the sound of them is, like, burned into my mind. When you startle them, they start this, like, shh sound. It's quite loud, and from a distance, it sounds like rushing water. But when you're up close to it, it's unmistakable. There's like nothing else it could be but a rattlesnake. And I was looking at some studies that were trying to figure out if different snakes rattled in different ways and why they rattle and the sort of arc of the rattling. Like, does it start slow and get high, and how does it change over time? And the results were quite interesting. They start suddenly, they have rapid onset within a few milliseconds, which fits in with this diametic display. Like, if it starts quickly, it's like turning on your TV at full blast. You have this like jump response that's fear. And then it continues at the same frequency for up to about 2 minutes at is sort of like the longer, on the longer end. And throughout, the frequencies stay the same between 2 kilohertz and 20 kilohertz. Which is in a sort of what researchers call a broadband mixture of frequencies. So a lot of different things can hear that. And it's effective across a range of prey and predator. But what's interesting is that there's very little in the ultrasonic, and there's very little in the rattlesnake's actual hearing range. So rattlesnakes can barely hear their own rattles. So it's definitely not something for communication, and it's not doing something for the rattlesnakes themselves. It's like a reflex. Just being startled or feeling that there's some sort of predator or danger nearby. Different species don't have a clear difference in sound, and it probably acts similarly to the way that birds and mammals do warning calls. So when a bird sees a predator near its nest, it will scream at it, and the scream happens in a different frequency band than its call does, or its song. And the scream usually happens in a wide broadband sort of thing to cover the bases. If animals can hear at different frequencies, and you want to make sure that if you're saying, get away from me, you're saying it so that as many different things can understand you as possible. Which I think is a really interesting way of thinking about animal communication between species or among species. The very last thing that I wanted to say is that it could be that this behavior in and of itself, which seems so diametic, and that it's a startle behavior, could also be aposematic if an animal, like a predator, has encountered a rattlesnake before. So through training, diametic behavior can become aposematic. When an animal realizes, this is bad for me, I need to leave, but it doesn't necessarily have that innate response in it from the beginning.
Nick, I think you wanted to tell us more about another very dangerous animal.
When I heard the topic danger, and I just thought, dangerous animals. So my immediate thought I couldn't get out of my head was tigers. Tigers, for the longest time, were the bane of humanity. They would frequently kill humans. I think some periods in the late 1800s, up to 6,000 people a year were being killed in some countries by tigers. Yes, that's a huge number. That's insane. Yeah. So, yeah, they are an incredibly dangerous animal. And there's a few reasons for that. Like, generally, they're just built to be dangerous. They're huge. They're the largest of the big cats, and the largest of the tigers is a Siberian tiger. They're absolutely massive and can quite easily accidentally injure you. So even people who work with tigers professionally in, like, movies and things report that even just, like, by moving their body quickly because they might feel a fly, they could easily break your wrist. So yeah, they are not to be trifled with. They are about 3 times heavier than a man at least, and much, much stronger. Their bite can have up to 1,000 pounds per square inch. So a hugely powerful bite, which they generally use to suffocate animals. Very similar to lions. I think we spoke about that before. So rather than this sort of imagining tearing and gutting and biting that we think of as like head-on fights, generally they'll be, even though they're so big and powerful, they will stalk their prey, jump on their back, use their sharp claws to hold on, drag them to the ground, and then bite their neck. And this neck bite will strangulate the animal and kill them. And they can use this to take down animals of a huge size, some over a ton. So they're absolutely massive and incredible hunters. They're most associated with forests. Even though they are fast, they can run up to about 30 miles an hour. They can only do this over short distances. So despite being the biggest cat, they are ambush hunters, which hence their markings, so they blend into their environment. They will sneak up and get as close as possible before attacking. If they're seen before attacking, they tend to abandon the hunt. Only 2 in every 20 hunts is successful. The males tend to be bigger than the females and have wider paws, so you can actually tell the gender of the tiger by its footprints, which I found quite fascinating. But the reason that I really wanted to talk about tigers is when I thought of danger, there was one tiger in particular that I thought of. Have you guys heard of the Champawat tiger?
I have not.
No, I'm not familiar with it.
So the Champawat tiger was a tigress, a female tiger, who lived at the beginning of the 20th century, about 1900 or so. And it lived on the border of India and Nepal. Tigers tend not to recognize international borders, so it would freely move between those two within its range. I believe Champawat is now in what is modern day Nepal. And the reason the Champawat tiger is made it into folklore is she is the most murderous of all the man-eaters. She is estimated to have killed 436 people.
That's insane.
Yeah.
That's more than I have.
But yeah, you think how tragic inherently we think of a plane accident being. And no plane accident has ever been as deadly as this one tiger.
Whoa.
Most of her victims were women. But this is not for any reason of the tiger preferring women. It's just that generally in that time, the responsibilities of women were to go and gather food from the forest or be out alone in the fields. So they were much more likely to be ambushed by the tiger. Obviously, when there's a tiger killing lots of people in quite a small village, there's efforts to eradicate it. And this was written by a guy called Peter Byrne. He was a professional hunter and author from Nepal. When her attack started, he sort of wrote the story about it. But the Nepalese army was called in. They organized a patrol to try and get rid of this tiger by killing it. They went out with their rifles and tried to shoot her. But she just moved territory. She ran away across the river and started killing in other villages. Now, normally, tigers in this region don't actually have very big ranges. What they do is they have a very small range, which they will control. Siberian tigers, on the other hand, have very, very large ranges, often hundreds of square miles. Whereas in parts of Bangladesh, I believe some ranges are only about 5 square miles. So not very, very big difference. But what this tiger did rather amazingly and intelligently is it adapted its range to be much more like a Siberian tiger. Its range would include several human villages. So after it would take one person from one village, it would go to the other end of its range and take someone else from that village. And in the middle of this range was a village called Champawat, which is why it's called Champawat Tiger. So it got to the point where killing her was becoming inevitable and the people were willing to pay a lot of money to get this done. The man who eventually did it was a chap called Jim Corbett. Now, he'd made many, many efforts, but the way he eventually caught this tigress was in 1907. And the tiger had just killed a 16-year-old girl. And she'd actually left a trail of blood, which Jim Corbett was able to follow. And despite following this, the tiger actually ambushed him while he was following her. And he managed to scare her off with 2 shots of the rifle. Later on, he shot her in the shoulder. And as she charged at him, when she was 6 meters away, he hit her in the foot and she collapsed.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah, slain 6 meters away from him.
And, like, definitely on her way to destroy him.
Yes. Yes. Very much so. I feel like she was looking him in the eyes.
Yeah, yeah. No, yeah. That's... Sorry, go ahead.
That's not the end of the story, though.
Amazing.
because they did a post-mortem on the tiger. And generally, she was a very healthy tiger. She'd obviously been quite healthy. She'd been hunting quite successfully. She was about 10, between 10 or 12 years old, and most tigers live from 10 to 15 years old. But there was one injury. It was an injury to her teeth. The upper and lower canines on the right side of her mouth were broken. The upper one was broken in half, and the lower one was broken right down to the bone. And what this meant... Ooh. Is that she probably couldn't hunt her normal prey, that her teeth weren't powerful enough for sort of larger antelope, which meant she had to adapt her hunting strategies to survive, which meant the only prey that was available to her was humans.
Mm-hmm.
And where they think she got that injury was from a gunshot from a previous failed hunt many years ago.
Wow. So look what we've done. We did it again.
I don't know if that counts as a revenge tale.
Absolutely. That's a Mother Nature revenge tale.
But yeah, it does sort of show that the unexpected consequences where we think we're showing domination over nature by hunting and killing it, that in fact we unleashed something we could never imagine.
Classic human.
But yeah, obviously a terrifyingly deadly animal. 436 deaths in a small rural region of Nepal in India.
And over, I guess, not... a particularly long time if she was only 10 or 12. That's, wow.
40 people a year. That's wild. That's almost a person a week.
Yeah, and that's assuming she started killing people's day one, which she didn't.
Right. Mm-hmm. Oh my God, a person a week? Can you imagine?
Men were refusing to go to work out of fear. If they heard a tiger roar in the jungle, no one would leave their house.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. And still, she still got someone every week. That's terrifying. You really brought the drama today. I'm going to cool things down a little. I want to talk about not danger, but something that reacts in an interesting way to danger. And when I say interesting, I mean viral video interesting. You've seen them. You've seen the fainting goats. We know about them. But what are they? Where did they come from? Why do they do that? For those of you who haven't seen the fainting goats, type in fainting goats to YouTube right now and watch the fainting goats. But those of you who know, you know. So the fainting goats are actually, it's like a breed of goats. It's a genetic behavior. And they're also known as myotonic goats, fainting goats, falling goats, stiff-legged goats, nervous goats, or my favorite, the Tennessee wooden leg goat. So. Yeah, enjoy those epithets. They suffer from a condition called myotonia congenita, which is hereditary, and it has to do with the chloride pathways in the muscles, which I'm not a physiologist, so we're going to have to call on a friend sometime to explain that one to us. But basically, it means that when they have a fear response, a startle response, which is common in all mammals, their muscles lock up. They can't release their muscles for several minutes. So they will often topple over. I think when I first was introduced to the fainting goat, I thought, wow, this is incredibly not useful for an animal to have this response. Because if you're being chased by something and then you suddenly you can't move your limbs and you fall over, you're done. There's like nothing that even an old tiger with no canines could eat you. But with these goats, this didn't appear and didn't evolve in wild populations. So this is something that we've sort of allowed by taking care of the goats to go through the population, and it's quite common in the south of the United States, and that's what's called the Tennessee wooden leg goat. But it started when a population of four goats were brought over from the Suez Canal in the 1880s, and they were sort of like, at first they were an anomaly. They were something that was sort of like, wow, these are some weird goats. And through two pathways they became very prevalent in the Southwest. One is that apparently one farmer in Texas, he was telling a story about having seen them, and his neighbors didn't believe him. And so he bought a bunch of them and started raising them and was like, see, it is like that. And the other pathway is they became the subject of some studies by some researchers who were looking at myotonia congenita in humans. So they became sort of like an interesting medical anomaly that could then tell us more information about ourselves. And by doing research on these goats, some researchers, like in the 1930s, Brown and Harvey, were able to understand the physiological basis of the condition and what it was caused by in humans and in the goats as well. And there's no treatment known for myotonia congenita, but they were studying the effect of hydration. And they found that if they deprived the goats of water for up to about 3 days, the myotonic symptoms completely disappeared. So the goats wouldn't freeze up anymore if they were dehydrated. But when they rehydrated them, then it appeared again after a couple of days. The very last thing that I wanted to mention about these guys is that they became really popular among farmers who were only able to build low-lying fences, because building a higher fence was a lot of resources that they couldn't afford when you were a pioneer farmer in the South in the 1880s. And these goats don't jump and they don't climb like their other goat compatriots do that don't have the stiff-legged condition. They burrow under fences like pigs. And this was seen as a huge asset by the farmers because they thought, well, we can build low fences and keep our goats in. So people started buying these goats, and now they're really widespread. Bizarre.
I thought it because they were adorable.
Well, that they are.
Great. I think with that, that does bring us to the end of this week's theme and an end to our episode. Thank you guys for sharing your research with me and our listeners this week. Please do join us again next week, where our theme will be organs. Thank you guys for joining us. Goodbye.
Thank you. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Frequent listeners will get it.
They won't. Naomi edited it out.